about religion that we have to remember when we're talking about that makes it such a hot topic issue is because we're talking about law. Who gets to be God? Who gets to be God's deputies? Who is the Most High? Who is the divine authority? It's all about the claim to the Most High. The only way that somebody can be higher than us is if we give away our power. Because there's nobody. We're all equal. But we're not equal in our knowledge. So ultimately, I think it does have to be a hierarchy, but it has to be a cooperative hierarchy, like a bee colony. It's about what our value system is, what we care about.
Hello, Universal Hive Mind. Today is August 6th, 2024. I'm your host, Nate Kapp, and welcome to the 72nd Cubbyhole Podcast, where critical topics are unveiled, discussed, and tested. The website for today's show is cubbyhole.com. That's CubbyWhole.com. And if you prefer to listen to the show on a different platform, you can also listen with Spotify, iHeartRadio, Amazon, TuneIn Radio, Pandora, Simplecast, YouTube, Odyssey, Minds, BitChute, and much more. If this is your first time listening to the show, welcome to the Cubbyhole. But as I've stated many times before, I definitely recommend going back to show number one, start there, work your way forward, go through the whole tapestry in order so that way you'll have a better understanding of the overarching message that is delivered in this Cubbyhole podcast, okay? As for all the listeners, all the studiers of this show, all those who have gone through this information in order, welcome back. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your attention. And I really appreciate all your efforts. And I really hope this information has served you well so far on your unfolding path to truth. Now, there is going to be very important slides for today's show. So please, if you're not already at cubbyhole.com, please go there and go to the top where it says podcast 51-100. Click on that, go all the way down to show number 72, and there you will find all the slides for today's show. And it's a very, very big show, a very important follow-up show to what I've been unraveling regarding the mysteries and how far back this information really goes. And I really hope you guys are ready to take a deeper dive into the eschatology, which is dealing with the study of final things. And I'm also really hoping that this episode draws out a deeper curiosity in people to really remember who they truly are and what we're really here to understand as sovereign stewards of this world. So, what we're going to unravel in this episode is where all these religions and these mystery schools really come from. Basically, what inspired them. So this is going to be all about the ancient Egyptian hero cults and really going deeply into this eschatology. Okay. Now, just as I stated on the last few shows, I need to remind us of the orientation that we should be in, just so we're on the same page with what I'm explaining, okay? So we are currently still drawing out of the chest of the third degree tracing board of esoteric Freemasonry, and really using all three degrees, all three tracing boards, but specifically the third degree. And we are remembering the spirit of care. Okay, this is what this is about, is we're trying to remember the spirit. We're trying to discover the spirit of care in order to rebuild and polish and even strengthen the modern pillar of today. of this huge sacred bridge that is barely connected to the ancient, you could say, robust pillar of the past. And what we're trying to overcome is the neglect and the apathy and ignorance that has basically obliterated the connecting archway back to this sacred pillar. Because this is all about an occult sacred bridge. Because it's about becoming aware of the occult and restoring that awareness as the bridge itself. So this is our divine conscious connection with nature. It's our divine conscious connection with our own sovereignty. It really is our direct lineage back to the ancient spirits, the adepts of the past. Okay, that's what this bridge is all about. It's about reconnecting with the raised elders of the past, the learned men and the learned women who preserved this beautiful science, this beautiful light, who preserved this light in stone and also in the stories, the mythos. So, in order to discover these preserved sciences, we are going through, we have to go through the underworld, through Amenta. So we're symbolically journeying through Amenta as a means of bridging the gap of this sacred bridge through the occult mystery traditions or the esoteric mystery schools, which is dealing with the Mist of Avalon. This is Amenta. This is analogous to Amenta. Okay, so we are symbolically sowing knowledge into the sacred garden. Remember, the bottom half of the zodiac is akin to the sacred lower half, the garden being the dirt, the soil, the black, rich soil, which is also analogous to Kemet, which is ancient Egypt, because it's about getting back to what is stored in this black soil. And so we are trying to reap truth and wisdom, especially ancient wisdom, okay? So we're bringing knowledge to the information, being the sacred garden, being the black, rich soil, in hopes that there will be truth and wisdom. So it's about bringing a seed and sowing that seed into the dirt and watering that seed and hoping that that seed will bring good fruit. That's the point. So we're filling this grail, this lower half of the zodiac, the cup. We're filling this cup, this grail, by demystifying the occult. We're demystifying the hidden realm. So bringing light to the hidden realm in order to reveal the truth. Now, I just wanted to share that with you just so you can really understand where this is all going, okay? But I want to now go over a couple of events and then catch us up on the last episode, so that way we can have a nice transition into the material for today. Okay, so just really think about what I'm saying. So we got some really great news. Brandon Martin has a brand new show, a new video series, which is called Beyond the Forbidden Veil, which is out now. If you'd like to check that out, you can go to the top of the Cubbyhole page and click on Seed, and that will take you to his Seed Truth website. And it is a very, very awesome new show, a great new high level initiation into the occult. And it's definitely aesthetically pleasing, very awesome. So if you haven't already, I definitely recommend giving that show a listen and a study. And obviously, there's only one show out as of now. So I'm definitely looking forward to seeing how that further develops. And I'm sure it's going to be really, really awesome as he lays out all the groundwork. And I'm really looking forward to seeing how it turns out. So now, my new presentation, Earth Brain 3, with the subtitle The Divine Synchromistic Orientation, will be out this November 3rd at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time this year, 2024. Okay, and this is a pre-recorded presentation, and I'm going to really, really put a lot of energy into this presentation. That's why I'm not going to do any more shows after this one for the rest of the year. I might do one, but we'll see. But I really just want to put a lot of time into this presentation to really bring everything together. If you've seen my Earth Brain 1 and 2, this presentation will be a very, very important follow-up that will really bring everything all together. It really will make everything make more sense. And of course, anybody who knows me knows that my work is very symbolic, so it will be a very symbolic presentation. And I am very much looking forward to seeing how it turns out. And I really hope that if you guys have found value in my Earth Brain 1 and 2, that if you would like to please share the poster that I left in the slide section, you can share that with your friends and family, or share it on your social medias, or you can share it on your podcast if you have a podcast. I really, really hope that this presentation reaches a lot of people, because even though part one and two are very important prerequisites to that presentation, I think it's also going to stand alone. So we'll see. But and that's really what I'm planning on doing. So that being said, we're going to go ahead and get into show number 71 and get us caught up, so that way we can really have a better understanding of what it is that we're getting into today. So on the last episode, I got into the Sacred Roundtable briefly, but talking about the mystery schools and just how important it is to be eclectic. Because eclecticism, when it comes to religion and mystery traditions, is all about syncretism. It's about getting to that which is central between all of these teachings. So that way you can really start to see how the sciences and how the ideas align. And the more that you can see how they align, and the more that you can really bring a lot of knowledge to that type of information, you can really start to see just how beautiful, the knowledge that is preserved in there, the real knowledge, how beautiful it really is, and how powerful the preserved proxies are. And so, you know, a lot of these traditions and these religions are highly demonized, and it's never ever going to be the knowledge that should be demonized. It should be how people use that knowledge that should be demonized, especially knowledge being used for the wrong reasons. If knowledge is being used for the lowercase will-based desires, for satanic purposes, being selfish purposes, being harmful purposes, then yes, that would be the wrongdoing. That would be the wrong way to use that information. But all knowledge is neutral, always. And therefore, we have to understand that it is about being eclectic and finding a way to really understand what is central between the traditions, between the knowledge of these teachings. And having the knowledge of natural law is really what gives you the spiritual armor to be able to deal with these religions and these traditions. Because if you don't have natural law, you can either become religious, or, you know, just become a zealot, or you can become an atheist, which means just reject it all and stay ignorant of all this information. And, you know, this is not really going to help anybody. So that's why natural law is so crucial to understanding this information. And I would say just being eclectic in general is going to give you the necessary armor to be able to deal with all this information. Okay. So one thing that I wanted to be very clear on when it comes to eclecticism is I really want to stress that it's not just about religion. It's not just about mystery schools. It's also about being eclectic with things like other sciences as well, like ancient archaeology or anthropology or psychology or symbolism or mind control, any control structure, really. But it's all about any science that you're bringing to the table, being honest about that science, being honest with what you know and what you don't know, and having as many sides as you can to really understand that fuller picture, because it's all about equilibrium. That's what it's all about. The more eclectic one becomes, the more equilibrium one embraces. Okay? So the other aspects that I got into, the other topics that I got into that I have been talking about are the Alpha and the Omega, being the beginning and the end. We're dealing with esoteric religion, truth, rejuvenation, mental material death, spiritual rebirth, the Mist of Avalon, the Zodiac, the inner journey of the soul, darkness, soil, the underworld, hell, the tomb, the womb, death, Osiris, metamorphosis, natural law, mystery traditions, mystery schools, and, you know, there's been so much more that I have talked about in the last five or so shows, especially dealing with the third degree. But when it comes to the mystery schools, especially on the last show, I got into Sufism, theosophy, runes, and, you know, runes, think about this, runes, I didn't talk about this on the last episode. I mean, there's a lot that I didn't talk about, but runes actually means, it translates to mystery or mist. So it literally is the mist itself. It is the mystery itself. Okay. And also, it's no coincidence, the green language, and I think even the word runes is actually also pronounced ruins. But it's no coincidence that, you know, when you think of ruins, you think of something ancient, right? The ancient ruins. So it's about the mist. The mist is about going through the ruins in order to get to the truth. And so just, you know, really think about that, because that tradition, that mystery school, really preserves that in its teachings. And I think that's just a very important, valid point that I wanted to make. But I also got into the mystery school of Thelema and also alchemy, dealing with vitriol. And on the last show prior to that, I talked about Rosicrucianism, Gnosticism, King Arthur, Kabbalah, Tarot, dealing with the death and judgment cards. And also, you know, Tarot is, you know, a lot of these mystery traditions has a lot more to do with eschatology. But one thing that I remembered that I really wanted to bring up, and I'm going to get into this card eventually, but it's the card of the Wheel of Fortune in tarot that is also dealing with eschatology, because it's dealing with birth, growth, decay, death, and then rebirth. And so that whole Wheel of Fortune also, I think anybody who is listening knows that that corresponds to the zodiac. And it is very, very filled with everything that I've been talking about. And I'm going to elaborate on that eventually. And it is such a powerful card to pick apart. And so we're going to get to that. Now, these mystery schools they're all useful tools that all of them, in some degree or another, they complement each other, and they possess unique sciences that can be used for light and growth, or for darkness and ego, and lowercase will desires, okay? So we really have to understand that, okay? Now, what we're trying to get to is, what is bringing these religions and these mystery traditions together? And I don't mean, you know, making anything new, like a new religion or a new cult or any type of new tradition. What we're trying to get to is, what is truly at the heart of these traditions or these religions? What is central between them? What influenced them to begin with? What is uniting them in their teachings? What's bringing them together? And this is something that I have been talking about quite a bit, which is the method of syncretism of their teachings, by learning the amalgamation, the blending of their sciences by understanding their similarities at their core. So the question is, what are the core teachings within these traditions? So we have to understand that it's a merging of their teachings by understanding the most sacred, pure sciences. Okay, so it's about eclecticism, being eclectic and pattern recognizing. You have to be able to pattern recognize when going through this type of information. So it's about using the archetypal sacred round table to discover and understand and pattern recognize the parts of the whole in order to realize the pure forms and getting back to those pure forms, which is a gradual development or refinement process, because it's about the refining principle. Because the pure forms are that which exists and are unmixed with man's perversions and romanticizations. And so one has to care enough to discover the dogmatic perversions and these romanticized, corrupt sciences of the mysteries in order to begin to see and understand pure form. You don't just arrive at pure forms, just as you don't just arrive at the truth. Okay? It is an unfoldment. It is about understanding that we're dealing with modern fragments of pure forms. So we're trying to pick up the pieces, aka Osiris. That's what Osiris teaches. We're trying to pick up the pieces through care in order to bring it back to its pure form. Bring him back to his pure form. Bring light that has been scattered back to its pure form. Okay? So that's about arriving at the truth through an unfoldment. And that's what it is. It's an unfoldment. It's about understanding that if we really want to arrive at the truth, we have to be able to square our square. We have to be able to perfect the Ashlar. This is all about the spire ritual, okay? Because it's an unfoldment in a spire or a spiral going to a point. The fixed point being truth, the principle. So we're on our unfolding spiral path, and we are refining, we're squaring our square, we're perfecting our Ashlar as we arrive to the point. Okay? And so this is also about animism, because it's about thinking animistically while using sacred geometry, realizing that everything natural in nature, everything not made by man or manipulated by man, is pure in its form. And elementary symbols are a critical medium for this concept, and so are archetypes and myths. Now, one way that we're going to further understand pure forms is through understanding what's known as sign language, okay? So we're going to go to the very first slide, which is a quote by Eckhart Tolle. And Eckhart Tolle, I really just am amazed, and I love the fact that I keep coming back to his work. I really have found a lot of value in his work, especially in the beginnings of my awakening. I think I was either 20 or 21 when I first read his book, A New Earth, and then I also read The Power of Now. But those books really helped me understand ego. And also, they help me understand living in the present moment. And so, his work to come back at this moment while I'm trying to explain something so deep and so sacred really makes me appreciate his work even further. But in his quote here, he states, "Watch an animal, a flower, a tree, and see how it rests in being. It is itself. It has enormous dignity, innocence, and holiness. However, for you to see that, you need to go beyond the mental habit of naming and labeling." Because naming or labeling something immediately fragments it from its pure form, right? So the moment you look beyond mental labels, you feel that ineffable dimension of nature that cannot be understood by thought or perceived through the senses. It is a harmony, a sacredness that permeates not only the whole of nature, but is also within you. So think about that. And, you know, this quote really sets the tone for the way the thinking has to be done for what I'm sharing today, especially in regards to sign language. And it's all about understanding that seeing something in nature as it is, being able to do this without words or labels, you know, just being, okay? And really think about what he's talking about when he says, you feel that ineffable dimension, which means it's undefinable, okay? No words can define it, okay? So I'm really hoping that this is going to help people be prepared for what I'm going to explain now, which is we're going to go into the next slide, which is the ancient stellar cult sign language, okay? And when we're talking about sign language, I know immediately people think of hand gestures, or they think of people that are deaf who can't hear or can't really speak, okay? And that is very important because it means that there is no communication with actual words, okay? But that is a modern understanding of sign language, because the stellar cult people, when they used sign language, it's because they didn't have words. They didn't have a language. They didn't have an alphabet. So we have to really be able to differentiate that, because this is the ancient sign language, okay? And so these people were not, I would assume, probably were not deaf, okay? They just didn't have the words. So the box on the top left states that sign language is a primitive invention as a mode, sign, or symbol that objectively stands for the undefinable one great spirit. So this is kind of like the tetragrammaton as a means for symbolizing or being a sign for the ineffable name. Okay, so this is like what we just read with Eckhart Tolle's quote. And this is something I've talked about a few times, dealing with the Hebrew four-letter symbol standing for the undefinable name for God, which is Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, which is the four-letter or four-symbol name, YHWH, So the name for God, which is in the modern day, is Jehovah. Okay. So just as I stated in the last episode, sign language is the true superior nature language. And it is a language that's not made of words. Words are a fragmented part of our nature language. Or you could say they are a fragmented part of our engagement, our relationship with nature. The word, as in resembling animals and trees, is all about the transmission of energy. It's a thought unthought. So bringing attention to anything natural without any human intervention or interruption, this is about stepping out of the confines of conceptualized thinking or, you know, forming thoughts, but instead actually participating in a state of connectedness, you know, stillness, and bringing attention to things like the trees or the animals or even rocks. Okay. So it's about perceiving and being aware. This is what causes a connected transmission of energy from those things to the self. Okay? So sign language, as it states in the top right box, sign language is a ritual, gesture, and mimicking of animals and their phonetic sounds. Okay? And when it comes to ritual and gesture and mimicking, first we have to understand that ritual means repetition. So this just means doing something over and over, you know, taking part in something over and over in a repetitive way and doing so for a purpose, something with an actual meaning. Okay. And the gesture is the performance or the wielding of or behavior. Okay. So it's about acting or performing a behavior with meaning, with purpose. Okay. And then mimicking is about imitation, right? To imitate or willfully express similar behavior of something or of another, okay? So think about totem poles, okay, as a symbol, okay, as an archetype. Think of all the animals and think of the structure of animals on those poles, okay? So think of the order from bottom to top. Totem poles are part of understanding sign language, which is part of being about mimicking animals, like, you know, bears climbing trees. You know, this is something that I stated in the very first Cubbyhole show that I don't think I ever addressed, which is, I think I said something along the lines that big bears, big adult bears can't necessarily climb trees or something like that, which I was wrong. The big adult bears definitely can climb trees. They might not be able to climb as high as a baby cub, but they definitely can climb trees. And I want to make sure that I state that I was actually wrong about that. So, I just remembered that. So, but this is about mimicking animals, like also like hissing snakes or birds chirping or flying. This is also about crocodiles that are halfway below the water and halfway above the water. Okay. And This is all part of understanding sign language. So the ritual is repeating these behaviors with gesture and meaning, with intent, with repetition, okay? So this is also the sacred art of tracing. Tracing is something I really want to get into eventually, but it's basically a key spiritual ingredient in sign language because you are essentially tracing or mimicking the ritual by going through the repetition. So going through the repetition, you know, repeating over and over and over is all about tracing over and over and over. You're tracing out, even with words, you are tracing out information of this ritual. You're tracing out how it works. You're tracing out how to, you're tracing it out in order to understand it. You're tracing it out in order to embody it, to be connected to it. So tracing is all about tracing not only the knowledge and not only the symbolism, it literally is about tracing out nature itself. Because as you trace, you are picking up the pieces. You're tracing out the pieces in order to put all the pieces back together internally. So the art of tracing is so valuable to understand. And again, I'm going to really break down this sacred art of tracing so people really understand what it's really all about, because it has everything to do with the interconnectedness to nature. It's a behavior that allows for not only growth and deeper understanding, but also it acts as a preserver. And this allows for the ritual to be perfected and get passed forward for future generations. Okay? So symbols or character representations of what's known as zootypes or animals is used to point at, and it doesn't have a name or a label. This is the ideograph. This is the ideographic behavior. It's about an image that expresses a thing or an animal without a name or without a word. And so the definition of ideograph in the middle states a character or symbol which suggests an object without expressing its name, just like I talked about with the tetragrammaton. Okay? And the symbol that we see on the top right, this is what's known as the gavel, the ancient gavel. But it's also the original nature, the NTR, the nature, the original nature symbol. So this is the symbol which is made of three sticks crossed, okay, which creates 7 points. But the stellar people, being specifically the ancient African pygmy people, this symbol was their most sacred sign. This symbol represented the one great spirit, which is 7, the 7 points, okay? And the 7th point is where all 3 sticks come together in the middle. Okay? So this symbol of the gavel, or this Netscher symbol, is the seven which preserves the three, or the three that preserves the seven, okay? And this is also the symbol for the cube, the three-dimensional cube as well. So that's very, very important to understand when trying to understand sign language. So this sacred symbol is a stellar symbol, or a sign that corresponds to the constellation of the Little Bear, which we see on the top left, okay? And the 7 points corresponds to the 7 stars of this constellation. And those 7 points are a major part of understanding the one great year, which I'm going to explain as we go through this information. But it's very important to understand one great spirit corresponding to one great year cycle, okay? Because it's all about preserving the knowledge. It's all about preserving all things seven, okay? And it's also about preserving the one great spirit. So this gavel symbol, or this Netscher symbol, is a very sacred symbol of sign language, okay? And so is the little bear, okay? So Albert Churchward, someone who I have talked about quite a bit, and I will continue to use this man's work because it is so stellar, pun intended. His quote: "The Egyptian ritual is written in the language of animals, and never was it read in the past. Never will it be in the future unless the thinking can be done in the ideographic type of thought. Merely reading the hieroglyphs as phonetics is but a primary lesson in sign language." So think about that. The Egyptian ritual, we have to understand, it predates words. It predates names. This is way before the alphabets of our world, okay? So it's a very sacred language. The ancient Egyptians, they spiritualized this nature language through all their rituals in order to preserve it, because they understood it was their direct connection to the Creator, or the one great spirit. So another man who I highly respect and will continue to use his work to understand this great mystery is Gerald Massey, who states that we have to learn the sign language before we can understand the nature of mythology. And I'd have to agree. You know, Gerald Massey is right on, because if the mythology is to truly be understood in its pureness, then the way of the thinking has to be exercised. It has to be entertained in the sign language. And like Churchward said, in the ideographic type of thought, okay, the gesture and the symbol and sign language. We have to be able to read nature without words, okay? Obviously, I'm not saying we shouldn't use words. We have to use the words in order to unfragment ourselves because it's all about picking up the pieces and putting everything back together in its pure form, right? And so nature is the pure form. That's where we find the pure forms. But we have to use words in order to get back there. But we also have to practice understanding the world of pure forms by being still. Okay? So that's truly a mentally sovereign way of seeing and thinking. Okay? And this is all about ancient Freemasonry. That's what true ancient Freemasonry is all about. So, that being said, I really hope you guys are making sense of what I'm saying. I know it's not an easy thing to conceptualize. It's not an easy thing to really, it's not an easy thing to connect to right away. At least it wasn't for me. So, I would say sign language and pure forms have been a very difficult part of my learning, but I am still learning this type of information. I continue to ruminate on this type of information because it is very, very valuable and it's extremely important to understanding this whole mystery. Okay. So we're going to go to the next slide, which is the mythological becomes eschatological. And this is very important to pay attention to. We really have to understand why the mythology comes before the eschatology. Okay, that's a very important part of this whole mystery. Okay, so in order to know this, we have to study the attributes and we have to study the rituals of the different phases of the ancient Egyptian mythos, beginning with the stellar, then on into the lunar, and then it becomes the solar, okay, which is dealing with the present day. Okay, so we can know that the stellar people didn't have an eschatology because they venerated in zootypes. And what I mean by veneration is they placed great respect and attention, awareness for the animal elements, the animal elementals, the animal behaviors, okay? And also, their buildings were filled with non-human iconography of the creations of the creator. And so the iconography is the art and symbols that are on the walls, on the temple walls, which was in, they were in zoo-type form, okay? So the stellar people didn't portray human form as human. It was zoo-types. And the zoo-types that they used were animals like snakes or crocodiles or birds. And, you know, there's a whole list of other animals. But this is a very, very important point. Because in the lunar phase is essentially where there is a transition. There's a transfer of knowledge from the stellar into the lunar. And during this transitional stage or phase, the veneration goes from the zootypes to human form, okay? So this is where they started to cross. This is where they started to mingle. the zoo types started to mingle with human form, okay? And then the solar phase, the solar people are the ones who began to venerate in human form, okay? They began to direct great respect and energy to human attributes that were mixed with animal characteristics, okay? So that's where that really truly began, was in the solar cult, okay? So they anthropomorphized, they humanized animal elementals, okay? And so if you're looking at this image, you see from the left, you see the constellation of the little bear, you see the totem pole, you see Horus, you see the jackal, and this is going from left to right. So you're going from stellar to lunar and then to solar, okay? So you have to see it through the phases. You have to see it from stellar to lunar to solar, okay? And you could even put Jesus Christ or other solar messiahs in the eschatological section, okay? And Jesus Christ is a very important part of this whole conundrum of going too far into the material, okay, away from source, okay? But we're going to get really into that, okay? And it's very, very, very important. So the mythology is about sign language, meaning the way in which specifically the stellar people learn to draw signs and symbols to represent elementary forces or powers in nature, because they had no words or language yet to express their ideas or to express their thoughts. So it was audiographic. It was signs that expressed animals without any names or labels, okay? So eschatology is about mythology applied to the human soul. So attributes of nature forces, like animals, that were applied with the human in multiple forms, like what we see on the right. And so from the beginning to the end of the written ritual of the mythos, we find it is based on the mythological representation, which was primary. It was first. It came first. So as the slide reads, another quote by Albert Churchward, he states that the mythical representation was first applied to the observable external nature, and this mode of representation was what continued through the stellar and lunar mythos and then reapplied to the human soul in the eschatology during and up to the present day of the solar mythos. So that is a very, very important point. So the way that I look at this is the mythology going into or mixing with the eschatology is really man perfecting his or her understanding of self from material back to nature. And especially because, you know, if we lose our way back to source, which I think most of our way has been obliterated, but we have the ability, if we really pay attention to nature, we can find our way back. Okay. It might take many lifetimes to do collectively, but we have the ability to find our way back to source. And so I'm looking at it like this. It's about straying from source. That's true. Okay. And the science of the eschatology and mythology basically acts as a type of bridge, or even you could call it a breadcrumb trail, which is preserving the evolution from material back to spirit. Okay. But to realize that the material mind in dominance becomes a devolved self that's ruled by the R complex, the fight or flight lower mind. Okay. The mind that attains and maintains this low belief in socialism and man's law. Okay. Control over others, control in the extant. Okay. Not control internally, but the external control being government control. Okay. So it's very, very powerful when you really look at it in the sense of, well, first, looking at it as straying from source is the most important part. Okay. But if you look at it from the standpoint that we humans are basically going all the way into materialism as a way of consciousness becoming aware of how far we can go. And I would say, due to going all the way into the material, is essentially the way that we can come to a crucial moment of choice, which is, do we continue going in this degenerated material mindset that is consuming the whole earth and destroying ourselves? Or do we find our care and work our way back to pure forms before we become completely obliterated? You know, I think that's really what we have to ask ourselves. And I would say, personally, I'm not going to allow myself to continue to go into the material. I'm raising spirit in the material instead. Because right now, there's a lot of material going further and further into enslavement without spirit. Because obviously, if there's spirit involved, the material is going to slow down. The material dominant mind is going to slow down collectively, okay? Because if we can raise our spirit into the material, that means that we can bring that material down from going too far in the realm of material dominance. And that's what we want to do, because it's about having that internal union. It's about the internal sacred marriage. Okay. It's about bringing the spirit and the body together. It's about bringing the feminine and the masculine together. It's about harmonizing in nature, because if we're too far in the material, we're not harmonizing with nature. We're in direct opposition with nature at that point, okay? Which is something I think anybody who has their eyes open can see. So we're going to go to the next slide, and we have a really powerful quote by Manly Palmer Hall. He states that the ancient philosophers believed that no man could live intelligently who did not have a fundamental knowledge of nature and her laws. And this is because natural law is the crux of the occult. It is the main master key to the whole unfoldment of the mysteries. Okay? Before man can obey, he must understand. And the mysteries were devoted to instructing man concerning the operation of the divine law in the terrestrial sphere, which means how to live on earth. Few of the early cults, especially the lunar and stellar, actually worshipped anthropomorphic deities, although their symbolism might lead one to believe they did. They were moralistic rather than religionistic, philosophic rather than theologic. They taught man to use his faculties more intelligently, to be patient in the face of adversity, to be courageous when confronted by danger, to be true in the midst of temptation, and most of all, to view a worthy life as the most acceptable sacrifice to God, and his body as an altar sacred to the deity, being the, you know, the personal relationship with the creator, right? So this is Manly P. Hall saying that the earlier cults were not humanizing the powers of nature, not in a literal way. They were animistic. You could say their application was animistic. They weren't literal. They were spiritually intelligent. So now we're going to go to the next slide, which is what the ancient Egyptian eschatology preserves. It is very important to go as far back as possible to see where these ideas truly originated from and how they evolved. So, what is it that the ancient Egyptian eschatology preserves? What is the science? So we have commencement and recommencement of a cycle, being to begin and end, and then to begin again. Okay? So eschatology deals with the anthropomorphism of elementary or elemental powers, which has led to the corruption of these celestial sciences, and thus the science of self. So we're trying to get back to understanding these pure sciences in nature, so that way we can understand what has been preserved in religions and the mystery schools. And I think it's really important to also address this anthropomorphism, because we really have to understand why the eschatology comes after the mythology. We really have to understand the word anthropomorphism, which means, it comes from the Greek words anthropos, which means human, and morphe, which means form. Okay? So anthropomorphism is about understanding the human form connected to anything. Okay? You can draw a face on the wall or on the sun, or you can draw a human face on a rock or on a tree. Once we start to, as a species, start to put human forms on nature, that is when the pure form starts to erode. Okay? So that is about getting away from pure forms. That's also about getting away from sign language, okay? So we really have to understand this whole transitional period. And so this is what has truly led to the corruption of these celestial sciences, is by anthropomorphizing, putting human attributes to these celestial sciences. And this is also what has distanced us collectively from the divine pure spirit. And again, the reason is due to neglect. It's due to apathy. It's due to laziness and cowardice and really ignorance. This is what has led to the corruption of these celestial sciences, and we have to restore this sacred bridge. That's what is happening right now. We are restoring this sacred bridge back to pure form. Okay? So, as we see on the bottom of the slide, we see the three ancient Egyptian hero cults, and they're in chronological order, going from left to right. Okay? And this is very, very important to make mention of here, because in order to really understand eschatology and its deep roots, we need to put the focus on the three great celestial bodies that have gifted us our internal science of self. And that being the sun, the moon, and the stars, and particularly the northern polar constellation being the Little Bear. Okay? And obviously the planets too, okay? But we're really focusing on these phases, on these cults first, okay? So these are the great inspirations. The sun, the moon, and the stars are the great inspirations. They are the sciences that are preserved, especially the cycles of the sun, the moon, and the stars. They are preserved in most religions and most mystery schools. But of course, they've become lost quite a bit, and they have definitely been fragmented over a long period of time. So they're basically submerged in layers and layers of proxies of today. Okay? So we have to peel back all these proxies to really start to see what is preserved. And so, you know, thanks to the preserved mythology and eschatology of the central Netcher legend, Osiris, and all the men and women that have kept this knowledge alive, we're now able to rediscover some of these beautiful sciences once more. And this is because Osiris, once you really start to invest time into this legend, into this central legend of this whole mystery, especially dealing with the solar mythos, what you realize is that Osiris is a universal storage compartment of instructions. And so as you come in contact with pieces of this great science, then you start to realize how it all fits together, because nature is pure. And as you bring all these sciences together, you start to see the pure form. You start to see this sacred, divine holiness in this information, because it's divine. So Osiris is scattered all throughout the world, all to the four corners of the earth, figuratively, okay, symbolically, allegorically. And so our mission, our goal, our purpose is to understand what that means. And obviously, you can go in all different directions to really try to figure this out. That's the beauty of it, because it is about understanding that all of this information is really leading to these beautiful sciences in nature. And the mythology, the eschatology of especially Osiris and all the Netcher gods, all the Netcher elemental forces, they are pieces of this whole picture that store the sciences of these celestial objects and their cycles, okay? And how that affects us on Earth, okay, in the terrestrial, okay? So all of these, all three of these different types or phases of the mythos have, in one way or another, or in one phase or another, has ruled the majority of the collective minds that understood these celestial sciences, especially through these elemental forces, these gods or goddesses, whether that be zoo types or anthropomorphic attributes, you know, human and animal forms, okay? And that doesn't mean that it's a bad thing, okay? I'm not trying to say this is a bad thing. I'm not trying to say straying away from source has magically been a bad thing, except we have to understand that if we are to become conscious of the fact of what's really going on in this world, being this world of slavery, where we're going further and further and further into materialism, aka socialism, aka, you know, this one world domination of these psychopathic rulers of our world, well, there is actually a way for those who care in this world, who really have the power of inspiration to spread this information out to others, to help them recognize that we're in danger of going all the way into oblivion. And we have this ability to rise back up and reconnect to nature in a proper way. Okay? We have that ability. It's fragmented, but I know with enough people at this round table, we can actually start to make a big difference in this world, because many hands make light work. So the more we become conscious of this type of information, the more we're going to see the world transform as the way we say we want it. We have to care enough, okay? So many people say they want to be free, but most people don't want to do the work. That's because they don't care. You have to care for freedom. And in order to do that, you have to care for truth. Because if you don't care for truth, freedom will never manifest, okay? And freedom means becoming aware of what is going to actually help us understand our human condition and where we are failing, okay? So we really have to care enough to be able to see where we are failing. So now we're going to go to the first box on the left, being the stellar. So the stellar mythos comes first in the ancient Egyptian mythos. It deals with the great year cycle of roughly 25,868 years, which is all about the precession of the equinoxes and the obliquity or shifting of the northern pole stars, which is shifting through 7 different North Pole stars over around a 26,000 year time period. And so each time period, all 7 time periods are around 3,695 years between each pole star in its primacy, okay? So this is a whole revolution. It's a whole full cycle of the equinoxes that completes this 25,868 year cycle, okay? So this is about the celestial heptonymous. And the heptonymous means the 7 rulers or the 7 fixed stars. And each of those 7 fixed stars will be the successor at, you know, some point whenever it's at its pinnacle around the being closest to the North Pole. Okay. So this is about understanding the Most High, the fixed stars or constellation being the little bear, which never set in the northern hemisphere. It never set below the horizon, which is why it's associated with the Eye of Providence. This is the Most High, okay? And these are the stars of this constellation that are closest to the pole, the North Pole. So they're fixed because they apparently seem to not move. Obviously, they do move, but they're seemingly still in contrast with the other stars that are surrounding them. So the more we look away from these fixed stars, the more we'll see movement in the surrounding stars, okay? And this is due to the Earth's rotation or obliquity, the wobble, okay? And this is something you really need to go look for yourself. You really need to go look at the maps of Polaris and look up the 7 pole stars that the Earth rotates through every, you know, 26,000 years, okay? Because as you get a better visual, this will give you a better understanding of the cycle going through all these pole stars, okay? And the primacy represents, like what I said, the 3,695 years, okay? And so right now, Polaris is connected to the tip of the tail of the Little Bear constellation. And this is also known as Ursa Minor or the Little Dipper. And the Little Bear is the closest constellation to the North Pole. And so this will always remain as being the Most High, being the 7, because the Little Bear is made of 7 stars, right? So this is all about understanding the lesser mysteries, because the lesser mysteries is the 7, okay? Remember what I said about the gavel. Remember what I said about the netcher, the original netcher, okay? The 3 sticks crossed, okay? This is the 7. This is the lesser mysteries, okay? This is about, because the greater mysteries are the 12 and the lesser mysteries are the 7. The 7 is closer to pure forms because as you work your way back from the 12 back to 0, you're trying to get back to pure forms, symbolically, of course, okay? So the ancient stellar people, they preserved all things 7 into this little bear constellation because it never sets below the horizon. And so this is what gives it the venerating credentials, if you want to call it that, of the symbolic Most High. And more importantly, it can never be destroyed by man. That is a very important aspect to this whole mystery of the 7, okay? And again, symbolically, this is the all-seeing eye. Okay. This is the eye of providence. And even if man completely obliterates itself, these seven pole stars remain. Okay. So if man somehow resets himself after he obliterates himself, those seven pole stars still remain because they're, you know, apparently fixed. Okay. From our perspective on Earth, they are apparently fixed. Okay. But since we're still here, and since the Great Pyramids of Giza still remain in Egypt, the middle pillar, the middle pyramid, retains the seven. Okay, it grounds the seven. And it was preserved there for us to find our way back to Ursa Minor being symbolically the Most High. So this is originally what's known as the Six Glorious Ones and Horus. This is the original eye of Horus. It was stellar first. Okay? This is way before the eye of Ra. Okay? It was the eye on the mount. This is the origin of the circled dot symbol. Okay? But the point is the obliquity of the earth, the wobble of the earth through a 25,868-year great year cycle, this will cycle through each of those pole stars until it does a full revolution, which is the original deluge. So this is the deluge, or the, you could call it the inundation of the North Pole, going through all seven pole stars as a full cycle. Okay? So this deluge, being the seven, also represents the agriculture, what I talked about with the sabbatical year being the crop rotation every 7 years, which is basically an analog to the inundation or the deluge, okay? So because this is the deluge, it's really important to understand that this is the idea behind what so many people literalize regarding the biblical deluge, okay? Or what's known as, you know, the flood of Noah, or Noah and the flood in Genesis, okay? The inundation. And really, this is all about the major one great year cycle, which is an ice age, okay? And according to the author, Alfred Wilkes Drayson, or he's also known as Major General Drayson, he states that the last ice age took place around 13,544 years BC, which is what brought the Arctic latitude line down to the 54 degree line of the Earth. And to basically put that in perspective, that's basically like ice walls that have come all the way down to northern France, or also, you know, over here in the States, you could say all the way down to the bottom of Canada, almost to the divider line between the United States and Canada. So really think about that, okay? And another important aspect to this is that the sun rotates around its own center or its own pole. And it does this every 25,868 years, which is from an ice age to an ice age when it's furthest away from the Earth. That's what creates these ice ages. So this is the great year cycle. that we're dealing with. And this is what I talked about in the show regarding primal fears. You know, the primal fear of abandonment, you know, of the sun going away from certain areas of the earth, but also away from the earth itself to some degree, okay? So the abandonment of the sun is very, very important to understand because it's tied into our DNA, okay? It's something that we have had to deal with for many thousands and thousands of years, okay? Hundreds of thousands of years. And we have to deal with it every day. You know, the sun rises and falls and goes away every single day. It goes away every year. It gets higher and lower every year. And then during a great year cycle or an ice age, this is also where the sun goes further away from the earth, which makes it very cold in the north and the south. And of course, you know, this is why the equator has been where most people are. Think about Africa. Think about the equator of Africa. Think about Ecuador of South America. Okay, think about all the ancient artifacts and all the ancient knowledge of these places closest to the equator. It's not just because this is the warmest place to be, but because this is also where most people migrate when the sun is moving away from the earth, or the earth is moving away from the sun, however you want to look at that, okay? So it is a very, very important science that I never hear anybody else talk about, okay? And of course, you know, there's definitely some reasons they don't want people to know that, because they don't want people to know that the climate actually does change because of a cycle. You know, think about all the patterns of cycles that we can think of, okay? We really have to give our attention to cycles if we really want to understand what we're really part of. Okay, because we don't, you know, we have such a low resolution of cycles in this world. We just think of, oh yeah, the sun cycles or the moon cycles, and that's it. That's the extent of our cycles. But when we really think about cycles, let's name off a few cycles just so we can really understand that the whole universe is just a cycle of cycles. You know, really think about this, because we have, you know, think about it microcosmically and think about it macrocosmically. Think about it in the quantum realm and think about it in the, you know, the whole universal cause of causes. Because just as I'm going through all these cycles, I just went through this cycle of the stellar. We have the cycle of the one great year cycle, which is a measurement of around 26,000 years, which is, you know, ice age to ice age. It's the sun cycling around its own center and at some point moving away from the earth just enough to create this ice age every 26,000 years. Then you have the moon cycles, you know, the waxing and waning of the moon cycles. You have the sun cycles, right? You have the day cycle. You have the annual cycle. And you also have, when it comes to human cycles, we have our blood goes through a cycle every 7 years where it resets itself. And we get new cells, and think about the menstrual cycles of females. You know, think about the cycles of, you know, 9 months of a child birth. you know, being pregnant for 9 months. And, you know, there's just so many different cycles that you can see throughout the whole animal kingdom, throughout the human kingdom, throughout the planetary system. There is just so many different cycles. You know, think about even that the sun, along with the whole entire solar system, orbits around the center of the Milky Way, which is called the orbital period. So this is the galactic orbital period, which takes about somewhere between 225 to 250 million years to complete this one full revolution. And this is often referred to as the galactic year or the cosmic year. So we have all these cycles all purposely interlocked and flowing with each other. And it's like this one enormous universal clock of gears, all intelligently intertwined all together as one giant spiral cycle. And, you know, when you really think about what this demonstrates visually and mentally is as above, so below. So this is a very, very powerful big picture that we can paint in our mind as we learn all this knowledge and see how it all connects, okay? And it's not by accident. It is a design. It's a very beautiful design, okay? It is something that has intelligence. There is intelligence behind the whole orchestrated universe, behind the whole cause of causes, behind the whole cycle of cycles. It's all interwoven with intelligence. Now we're going to go to the lunar phase of the eschatology, which is, this comes second in the ancient Egyptian mythos, okay? So this science is the least talked about regarding the whole ancient Egyptian mythos, okay? So the stellar mythos eventually transitions into the lunar as time was then measured by moon phases, okay? So time measurement as the science in the mythos was essentially brought down as a veneration into annual cycles, okay? So the priest class of that transitional period, they wanted to put a finer point on time, okay? And it's very important to understand that, because in the stellar, the veneration, the sacred attention, the preservation was in the northern circumpolar constellation of the Little Bear, while also recognizing the annual cycles of the sun and the moon, okay? So it's not that they weren't aware of the annual cycles during the stellar mythos. They definitely were. It's just that they understood the danger of this transition. And part of the danger was losing the chronology of the long epochs of time. They understood that transitioning the mythos of the stellar into the lunar, that this could lose this great year chronology and basically everything else that was associated with it. And as we can see, that is what has happened. And They also apparently understood the dangers of moving into solar annual cycles, because this could eventually lead to solar veneration in the northern hemisphere, which would lead to mass materialism. And again, this is what we're seeing today, okay? Because as you venerate in the north hemisphere, you venerate the sun, the solar, in the northern hemisphere, you're venerating the material, the masculine. Masculine is always associated with material. Material is light. Light is masculine, okay? So if you're venerating in the masculine, if you're venerating in the sun, the material, this is what makes people become more material, because they're putting material on top of the spirit, okay? This is what venerating in the northern hemisphere has done. And the northern hemisphere is associated with the left brain, which is masculine, okay? So this is material and material together. This is complete masculine veneration. So this is why the pyramids were built the way that they were built. One of the reasons, anyway, because they were trying to warn future generations that if we went too far in the north and venerated in the sun and the solar cycles in the northern hemisphere, this would create a masculine imbalance internally, which would reflect outwardly. This would lead to internal materialism, okay? So it was a warning that they gave by building those pyramids, okay? That's one of the reasons that they built the pyramids. People always get away from why the pyramids were built. Always pay attention to what most people are talking about. Most people are always talking about how the pyramids were built and who built the pyramids, but no one ever really questions why they were built, okay? And there's a few other reasons why they built them, but the point that I really want to stress is that they built them as a warning sign to not go venerating in the day sky in the northern hemisphere. So they gave us this big warning, and because we're becoming conscious of it today, we do have the ability to change this. We really do, okay? But we have to become conscious of it first. And a really important key point about the stellar people is that they favored, or you could say they propitiated, elemental powers and human ancestral spirits. And this is part of understanding the sacred bridge that I'm talking about, okay? Back to the ancient elders, okay? Back to the spirits, the adepts of the past, okay? They had a direct connection to these adepts, to these ancestors that eventually became lost when venerating in annual cycles, okay? So this was about keeping the ancestral spirit connected as a means of preserving the chronology of the great year cycle, okay? So really think about that, because we really have to understand how important it is in preserving this information and to not let it get lost anymore, to not let it get lost any further, for one, but to just not let it get lost ever again. So now, the inundation being the cycle, was measured in the circumpolar constellation of the Little Bear and Great Bear, dealing with the seven. So it's about transferring the knowledge and sciences of the stellar into the lunar. Okay. And this is what the first degree tracing board by Josiah Bowring is all about. Okay. Specifically, his tracing board, because it's about understanding that that eye of providence is the little bear, the light of the little bear, or the eye of Horus, which is the light that is transferred into the lunar. That's why the crescent moon, the light of the crescent, is the light reflected from the stellar, okay? Because it's about the transfer of the stellar into the lunar, the transfer of the stellar knowledge into the lunar, okay? Into the lunar mythos. And the moon god, Taht, T-A-H-T, the lunar god Taht became the measurer and keeper of time regarding the Great Bear and the inundation, and also the moon, okay? So this moon god Taht is a very important aspect of getting our measurement back of the stellar, okay? Because Taht is the god who preserves the knowledge of the stellar light that is passed into the crescent, okay? So the measurement of time in the great year cycle was preserved into the lunar cycle, into the lunar god Taht, the crescent, okay? This is about the bow or the arc of the deluge that was passed on into the lunar crescent, okay? And Taht is also equivalent to Thoth, okay? Thoth is also about understanding the word taught, to teach, right? Because that's what the measurement is about. The measurement is about measuring things out against each other, okay? That's how we learn. That's the point of Thoth. That's the point of Taht, because they are the messengers. They are the ones who measure out time and cycles. And so they are symbolic. They are symbolic of how we learn how to measure things against each other in order to understand pure forms, in order to really understand cycles better, okay? So that's one of the reasons that they have these names that are phonetically very similar to teaching or to have been taught something or to measure. They are the measurers. They are the measuring gods, okay? So that means they are the measuring teachers. They teach us how to measure. So when it comes to how we measure an annual cycle through the lunar, we have to understand that if we're looking at the middle box of the lunar, I'm reading through that now. This is about understanding that Taht represented the five epigonal days of a 12-month, 30-day month annual cycle, okay? And again, epigonal, this is something that I have talked about many times. Epigonal means days out of time, or the five holy days. Okay, so the epigominal days were not just in the solar, they were also in the lunar, okay? And a really, really important goddess that we should pay attention to when dealing with eschatology is the lunar goddess Heket, which is represented as the moon in its transformational phase. Okay? So she is associated with the goddess Hathor in the lunar cult. And her zootype was mostly a frog, okay? A frog head. She was frog-headed, okay? And Heket was a prophet of rain and also a prophet of the inundation, and also represented resurrection, which then she transforms into Sati, S-A-T-I, who was known as the Lady of Light, who brightens up the darkness and overthrows the devouring serpent monster, okay? You know, and think of, I talked about the golden age of the Satya Yuga, the Yuga cycle, okay? And this is important because Sati also being the Lady of Light is also akin to Satya. So Satya and Sati are very similar, okay? And I'm just pointing that out because Satya represents golden age and Sati represents the Lady of Light who brightens up the darkness, okay? And so Satya, the Satya Yuga, brightens up the darkness of the Kali Yuga, okay? And this transformation was applied to the renewal of the moon in the mythology, but we have to understand that in the eschatology, it was the transformation of the mortal material being into the immortal spirit being. Okay. Now, the lunar mythos also deals with the 13-month cycles per annual cycle with 14 waxing and 14 waning angles of the moon per 28-day cycle, okay? That's really, really important, and that's something that I've talked about quite a few times already. But this science is so important to also understand the battle of the infamous battle of Horus and Set in the lunar mythology, which is what took place with Horus as the light half and Set as the dark half of the moon. And the winning and the losing of their symbolic war was equivalent to the waxing and waning angles of the moon. So the waxing of the light was Horus winning and Set losing. And then the waning angles was Horus losing and Set winning, okay? So that's very, very important to understand that battle within the lunar mythos. So the lunar is very evident with the eschatology because Osiris, the lunar god, is cut up into 14 pieces, which is a full waning lunar cycle from the full moon to the new moon, and he's cut up by Set. Okay, so this story, this part of the myth, is coming from the lunar into the solar. Okay, so we have to understand that. And so the waxing of the moon is the symbol for care. Okay, and this is definitely tied in with the lunar swastika as well. Something I'm going to get into in future shows. But, you know, there's just so much regarding the moon, okay? Because the moon is what ties the stellar to the solar, okay? This is the in-between phase. So just remember, the lunar preserves the five extra days in the Netcher god Tot or Thoth, okay? So we really have to understand that. We have to understand how that really gets brought down. And I know it's very difficult to understand because the lunar mythos is the least known about, okay? So we have to get as much of the information as we can to really restore this phase of the whole Egyptian mythos. And the whole phase represents Care itself, okay? That's how I look at it, because if we really care about restoring this bridge, we really have to care about the lunar, okay? Because the lunar has been the least preserved, yet it is the substance, it is the middle aspect to the solar and the stellar. And the more that we can learn about the lunar, the more we can really understand the stellar, okay? And we can learn a lot about the lunar through the solar, because the solar preserves the lunar and the stellar. The lunar preserves the stellar, okay? But they all complement each other. The stellar preserves the lunar and the solar as well, okay? The lunar preserves the stellar and the solar. They all preserve each other because they all work with each other. It's just one can become more dominant than the other through the evolution of the phases of the mythos, okay? So we really have to pay attention to that, and we have to understand stellar comes first, then lunar, then solar, okay? And there's a reason for that. There's a very beautiful cosmic spiritual reason for that, okay? And we're going to get into that. So solar on the right, in the box on the right, this comes third in the mythos. And again, the time was changed. It was changed over from the stellar and the lunar time on over to the solar timekeeping, which includes this Gregorian calendar that we find ourselves very much attached to in the modern day. Okay. So it deals with waxing and waning angles of the sun during a four season, 365 day annual cycle, beginning with the waxing from December 25th, the waxing of the sun from December 25th to the lowest waning angle being winter solstice in the northern hemisphere, okay? And that's very, very, very important to understanding our whole year, okay? So we have to understand that the winter solstice and the 3 days that are following the solstice are the lowest point of the sun in the correct orientation, okay? So the new year, when we really think of when a year truly starts, when it really truly begins, is on the 25th of December. Because this is the time that the sun rises 1 degree north to begin its new waxing trek back up to the summer solstice. You know, think about this symbolically, because it's going from the depths of the dark womb where it's symbolically conceived of the southern hemisphere, and then it moves up, it waxes up to the spring equinox birth, and then on up to the summer raised solstice, right at the peak. Okay, this is when the sun is at its highest in the northern hemisphere, which then after that, after it has raised to its peak, Then 3 days following the summer solstice, the waning angles begin. The sun starts to drop back down to the winter solstice. Okay? So we have to understand, waxing of the sun from the 25th of December up to the summer solstice, and then for 3 days after that, it begins its waning angles where it's dropping down to the winter solstice. That's how the orientation has to be. Okay? We have to understand the southern hemisphere is the sacred feminine. This is the black soil. This is the womb. This is the right brain. Okay? So we really have to be oriented if we really want to understand why the new year is on the 25th of December. So this is what helps us understand that death is a word for material in the real world, because just as, you know, plants and trees and other green plant life falls or seemingly dies, or actually does die, the sun continues. Okay, so this is the idea behind the immortal soul, okay, that continues even after death, whether that be a material mind dominance death or a real physical death. And that's even why the sun in Latin or Spanish is sol, S-O-L. Okay, it's phonetically the same as S-O-U-L, the soul, because the soul continues even when the material mind no longer rules the body, or literally, when the material body becomes cold and brittle and even deathly. Okay, so the sun continues to rise and fall regardless of the material conditions of the earthly, the terrestrial, okay? Like winter, okay? So this is the science that has inspired our eschatology, our understanding of eschatology. That is the eschatology, what I just stated, okay? Because it's about the sun coming to its final low waning angle, okay, down to the winter solstice. And then on the 25th, the sun rises 1 degree north and continues that waxing, raising angle, which is akin to the soul rising, okay, back up into the material, the left brain, okay? And I know that that can lose a lot of people, but just try to orient your whole brain to the earth hemispheres, okay? So the lower hemisphere is the right brain. The upper hemisphere, the northern hemisphere, is the left brain, okay? And we can know this by orienting our mind correctly to the rising sun. Okay, that's what orient means. It means aligning your whole head and direction to the rising sun from the east. And so if you align your sights to the rising light, being the eastern light of the sun, the southern hemisphere is the right brain, and the northern hemisphere is the left brain, okay? So we have to stay oriented, and this is how we're going to learn this eschatology. This is about getting back to pure form, okay? And also, every day, think about this, the sun waxes and wanes, or rises and falls, which is also a solar cycle. So continuing to read this, every day the sun waxes and wanes or rises and falls, which is also a solar cycle. Okay? That's very, very important to understand because it's very simple. It's one day, 24 hours. Okay? And Sunday, the day of the beginning of the week or the end of the week, is also commencement and recommencement of a week because it is the end and beginning of a week. So I want you to really think about this because this 7-day week with a Sabbath on Saturday, which is Saturn's day, which is a Jewish holiday during the week, and then you have your Christian solar holiday being Sunday, right? So you have your Saturn day and you have your Sunday, and these are holy days of the week. And we have to understand this is a religious invention, and this is to keep people always tied to having this idea of Sunday as a Christian holiday, something that is always going to be their Sunday, and then the Sabbath or Saturday is always going to be a Jewish holiday. And think about this. Also, you know, think about green language of the weeks, because in English, you know, to work all through the week and then have your weekend off and then you have your religious holidays of the week 4 times a month, roughly. This is all about being weak, you know, getting weak as you work through the week, right? And then the weekend is to be weekend because you've worked so hard all week and now you're weakened by the weekend, right? And what do when you're weakened? You go to, a synagogue or a church and you get rejuvenated by the Creator, by giving your time to the Creator, right? Of your religion or tradition, right? So it is a constant way of keeping people in this 7-day loop of continuously giving that one day of rest to a religious holiday. And Sunday falls on this 7. But there are not any 7-day cycles in nature when it comes to the solar. Okay. And also, Sunday is considered the last day of the week, but it's also considered the first day of the week. We have to understand the Gregorian calendar has Sunday at the first day of the week, but many people believe the first day is actually Monday, which makes them think Sunday is the last day. So this is all part of the confusion, and also it is definitely solar cult overlap to keep the dominance of the solar religion in people's minds constantly, okay? Because this is solar mind control, to keep the solar as the alpha and the omega, the material light. You know, so the end of the week and the beginning of the week is solar constantly. Okay. Sunday is the beginning. Sunday is the end constantly. Okay. So this is to keep people in this material light. Okay. To keep people bound to this solar messiah. But of course, this week of 7 days is a preserver of the 7. Okay, so we can't forget that. So let's not throw the whole baby out with the bathwater we have to understand. When I'm talking about there's no 7-day cycles in nature, there aren't any 7-day cycles in nature, really, okay? Especially not dealing with the extraterrestrial or celestial, if you want to call it that, cycles of 7 days dealing with the sun, the moon, or the stellar, okay? That's what I'm trying to make a point of. But it is, the 7 days is preserving the seven as far as the seven stars that the pole shifts through every 26,000 years, okay? Through the North Pole, okay? The North Pole stars, okay? And the preserver, though, that is dealing with the seven and solar is specifically the creation story that's found in the book of Genesis in the Bible, okay? So we have to remember, there are 52 weeks in a solar annual cycle, which are 7 days each week, okay? And that's very important, too, because 5 + 2 in gematria is obviously 7, okay? So the solar year preserves the 7 through 52 weeks. And this also corresponds to the 7 Elohim, which is the 5 planets and the sun and the moon, okay? The wanderers. So the wanderers are the brightest to the dimmest, or dimmest to the brightest, however you want to look at that. But the brightest is the sun, then the moon, then Venus, then Jupiter, then Mars, then Mercury, then Saturn, okay? But the point is that this is why we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater, okay? We cannot do that. We have to understand that this 7-day week does preserve some very important aspects to our relationship with the celestial objects, okay? But of course, there is another correspondence too that I'm just now realizing, which is that there are 4 weeks of 7 per month, okay? And 7, 7, 7, 7 is corresponding to the lunar as well, okay? Because 7, 7, 7, 7 is 28, okay? But obviously, in the solar, there is so many different days of 30 and 31, and then you have your February day with 28 or 29, depending on the leap year, okay? And leap year is also a very important component to all this, but we're not going to get into that. And I'm sure people are wanting to understand that or wanting to make sense of that. But just remember, it's really about understanding how to correct the year, okay? Because we have to understand that because we're not in exact alignment through the measurement system. The measurement system is very difficult because there is a wobble. We have to understand there really isn't 24 hours in a day. There's actually some extra seconds in a day if we really were to measure everything out correctly, but we round everything up. Okay, so that whole leap year day is about a rounding up. Okay, and there's more to it, but again, I'm not going to get too far into that. But, you know, when it comes to the 7 and the cycles, especially in understanding the cycles of the human, we have to remember that, again, every 7 years, there is a rhythmic cycle of blood cells being renewed during that time. So every 7 years, the human body gets rid of old blood cells and renews the blood cells. Okay, so there is a biological pattern in humans with the seven, okay? And seven is so, so important to understand. All things seven are very important to understand and how they correspond all through nature, okay? But the way this is preserved is not only in the cult of Osiris, which was the perfected eschatology, but in the latest phases being Jesus Christ, the so-called solar messiah of the last 2,000 years, because it's about the death and resurrection of the sun in its solar cycles, okay? But Jesus Christ as a proxy for the sun going to his death and then being resurrected is the eschatology. But when it comes to Jesus Christ, this is where this eschatology becomes distorted and deteriorated, and it loses its real science, because it is dealing with a fully anthropomorphized deity, which is fully humanized and fully personified, you know, being literalized, the literalization, especially of his corpse, raising from the tomb as a literal story, rather than understanding it's about spirit being raised, okay? And it's because most people don't understand that the sun is a proxy for spirit, which is about the non-temporal unseen forces in nature. It's not something historical, okay? That's what Christianity has been pushed into. It has become this historicized story that people have grown to believe, and this is what has caused materialism in our world today, okay? And really has for a very, very long time, okay? And it's not just Jesus Christ. This has been happening for a long time with other solar deities or solar messiahs that came prior to Jesus, okay? So again, venerating in the day sky and worshiping the sun without understanding this, this is what causes literalism. This is what causes the materialism. And this is also why the darkness is heavily demonized in the Abrahamic religions, because darkness is always associated with evil in these religions, okay? And because of this, they're throwing the whole baby out with the bathwater. They're throwing spirit out with evil, never truly learning either one, because they've been easily duped. They've been easily manipulated in the mind. They've been indoctrinated, okay? Plain and simple. Now, you know, this word evil, think about this. The word evil, the green language, is Eve is ill. So this means evil in the self, as in ignorance, is what causes the sacred feminine to become ill. Eve is the sacred feminine. And this is why we have to go into the dark and face the dark and become well, and also evolve. We have to understand that Eve is ill, and we have to evolve. We have to evolve out of the ill, because the illness is the mind that has become materialized. So we live in a world of Eve ill, which is the ignorance Evil is ignorance. Ignorance is evil. So this is what creates literalism. This is what gets people away from animism. This is what gets people away from spirit. This is what gets people away from the sacred feminine. This is what creates a dominating material mind over the spirit. This is about keeping and maintaining the square over top of the triangle. Okay? The goal is to raise that triangle above the square. Okay? Or even the triangle within the square. Okay? Depending on how you want to explain that. And we also have to understand that the idea of eschatology and its development, especially in the ancient burial rituals, this is about a healing process. It's about healing the sacred feminine, especially. Okay? But it's first and foremost about paying attention to nature and recognizing the path of the celestial objects in relation to the terrestrial. So recognizing the path of the sun from east to west through the day sky, and then the way that it sets in the west, which then creates what? It creates darkness. And then it seemingly goes under the world in the west while in darkness. Then, of course, as the sun goes through the underworld, symbolically, then it rises again in the east, the rising light. Okay? So this is all about understanding the greater mysteries, which is mostly associated with the solar 12. Okay? And this 12 corresponds to the zodiac, the 12 houses of the zodiac. Okay? And this is about the 12 houses that the sun moves through annually. Okay? But also keep in mind that the 12 houses are also the 12 houses that we go through in one great year cycle. Okay, so we go through all 12 houses through around a 26,000 year cycle. Okay, so this is about ice age to ice age, and that is very important to understand when you're trying to understand the 12 houses of the zodiac. So it's about big picture thinking. Now, when it comes to the zootypes in the mythos, when it comes to further understanding sign language and the eschatology, especially the stellar people in their mythos, they understood the human soul wasn't ever literally a bird, okay? But it could be imagined as a bird on the grounds of likeness. You know, like when we think of a hawk, a bird, a hawk bird that's lifting off from the ground into the air, this was analogous to the rising sun, which was then eventually named Horus, the hawk, who then flew through the sky, the upper regions or heavens, being the trek of the sun. And that same hawk in the eschatology was applied to the human soul as the symbolic resurrection from the lower material body once the human soul had passed through the underworld. Okay, so think about that ideographically. Think about that without words. If you can think about that without words, if you can paint that whole image in your mind without words, that will really help you understand this whole idea of sign language, and it will help you understand the mingling of the mythology into the eschatology, okay? And this is a very powerful realization to have, okay? So the sun symbolically in the underworld, or Amenta, represents the journey of death of the material light, which is represented by Set murdering Osiris, the god of the living. And then the rising sun would be the resurrection of the soul, the rising of spirit light, which is then Ra or Os-Ra, okay? The solar god Ra, okay? So this represents spirit fully raised, okay? Or raised, okay? That's the eschatology. That's the afterlife cycle. That's the idea behind being reborn, or the rebirth of the soul. And this is what's so misunderstood from those who solely believe in the historical end times through religious belief systems. And the belief in literal end times is the destroyer of the imagination. It's the destroyer of hope and freedom. That is the world that we live in today. So we have to get back to thinking animistically. We have to get back to natural law. We have to get back to allegory. We have to get back to symbols. We have to become symbol literate. We have to get back to understanding archetypes and legends, because these are the things that preserve the sciences of self that are connected to these pure forms in nature, okay? And also, something I've already talked about many times already on this show is the five epigominal days of the solar mythos, okay? These are the days out of time. Or you could say there are the five holy days. So these are the timeless days of the year. And these timeless days are attributed to Nut and Jeb. And Nut and Jeb, their children are Osiris first, then Horus, the elder, then Set, then Isis, then Nephthys, okay? And in that order, okay? So this is preserved in the X symbol. And the X symbol is Osiris, because Osiris is the crux. Osiris is the center point, okay? And the X ties the 365-day year cycle together as a 360-degree divine circle, with the five extra days being accounted for by these netchers, okay? So this is about understanding 360 with the square, with the X going from corner to corner, crossing in the center, finding the center point, okay? That is Osiris, okay? So these hero cults preserved the science of the sun, the moon, the stars, and the planets. And these celestial beings from outer space, they are the true off-world beings the true divine teachers and inspirers that have taught us terrestrial beings here on Earth how to operate in and with nature. They've taught us the importance of when to plant and when to harvest. They've taught us the journey of the soul and how to deal with death. They've inspired us to preserve knowledge for future generations. They've taught us about our traumas. They've taught us about our alignment. They've taught us about the art of balance and orientation in the cosmos. They are the lesser and greater mysteries in pure form. So we really have to understand just how important these celestial beings really are. And I think, you know, anybody listening to this is starting to get a picture of what that really represents. So now we're going to go to the final slide for the show, which is the aphanism. And aphanism comes from the Greek to conceal. Okay? So just remember, aphanism means to conceal. So this definition of aphanism comes from the Encyclopedia of Freemasonry, which was written by Albert Mackey, and I highly recommend that anybody who really wants to understand Freemasonry a lot better, a lot more thorough, you definitely need to get a copy of that. And maybe I think I have a PDF, and I'll leave that in the description. If I do, I'll look for that. But it is very, very vital to understanding modern Freemasonry and even ancient Freemasonry as well. So this definition of aphanism states, in each of the initiations of the ancient mysteries, there was always a legend of the death or disappearance of the same hero god and the subsequent discovery of the body and its resurrection. The concealment of the body by those who had slain it was called the aphanism. Okay, so think about Hiram Abiff being slain by the three ruffians. Okay, so that means, you know, cowardice, apathy, and ignorance. So as these mysteries may be considered as a type of Freemasonry, as some suppose, and as according to others, both the mysteries and Freemasonry are derived from the common and ancient type, the aphanism, or concealing of the body, is of course to be found in the third degree. Indeed, the purest kind of Masonic aphanism is the loss or concealment of the word. So, aphanism can be looked at as spiritual death from the lower behaviors, being, you know, laziness, cowardice, apathy, and ignorance. Or it can be that concealment is overcoming these lower behaviors with moral responsibility. So this aphanism is like a crux, okay? It's a concealment. The X symbol actually means concealment, okay? So think about that. It's about concealment of light. It's about concealment of equilibrium, to not let ignorance and apathy and laziness and cowardice destroy the light or equilibrium. And think about this very deeply in the self. This is something to be thought about in everything about yourself that you can think of. It's a concealment. It's personal. The aphanism is personal, okay? And a really great movie that I actually just recently saw about this aphanism that really demonstrates this aphanism really well is the movie called The Lost City of Z. The Lost City of Z. Watch that movie and study that movie, okay? It's a very, very powerful, powerful allegory. And it actually has the main character in that movie is actually the main character from the King Arthur Legend of the Sword. And I believe his name is Charlie Hunnam. But this movie is so, so powerful. And I can't believe I just saw it, because it really is. I mean, it's synchronistic that I just saw it, because I was working on this show, putting this show together, when I saw it. And it blew my mind, because it completely demonstrates the aphanism, and really it demonstrates this whole eschatology that I've been covering. So a very, very, very powerful movie that I recommend, you know, people really study that movie. So just real quick before I end the show, what I covered in this episode is sign language. I covered pure forms. I covered mythology, zoo types, and I covered anthropomorphized deities, which is tied to the eschatology. And then we went much deeper into not only the way the mythology became eschatology, but what is actually preserved eschatologically in most religions and mystery traditions, being the sciences of the cycles of the stellar, the lunar, and the hero cults, dealing with the little bear constellation, the moon, and the sun. Okay, so the stars, the moon, and the sun. And it has to be understood in that order, okay? So this is all about getting back to pure forms. And the way that we're going to do that is we got to understand the shadow of the proxies, okay? We have to understand the layers of the proxies that are covering up all of this sacred pure form science, okay? Now, this is probably going to be my last show for the year, as far as I know, and there might be a chance that I squeeze one more in before this year is over, but we'll see. But I'm going to definitely put a lot of time and effort into my new EarthBrain 3 presentation, aside from a lot of other responsibilities that I need to attend to. So that being said, again, please feel free to join in and check out my EarthBrain 3 presentation that's coming up this November 3rd at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time of this year, 2024, okay? And I will definitely make sure to have more information up on the Cubbyhole website. And this presentation will be streamed on YouTube and Odyssey for sure. Maybe it will be on Rumble, but I'm not sure yet. And also, if you want any updates, you can also go follow me on Outcasting on Telegram, because I'll be giving more updates there as far as my social media, and on Facebook as well, under Nate Cap or Cubbyhole, Cubbyhole Network on Facebook. You can find me there. But if you guys, again, if you found value in Earthbrain 1 and 2, and you'd really like to get the word out, help me get the word out and support this Earthbrain 3 presentation, you can share it with your friends and family, share it on your social media, share it on your podcast if you have one, and it would be very much appreciated. So that being said, I really hope that anybody who's made it this far, I really hope that you have found value in my work as far as the eschatology and really demonstrating just how far this information goes. And I really hope that it has opened people's minds and has given people more of a precise vision of how to and how important it is to go back into the ancient world to really understand how vital this information is to our sovereignty and to our connection to nature and to each other. So it is a very big deal, and I'm going to continue to lay this information out as I come back on in the Cubbyhole in future shows. So I really thank you guys for tuning in, and if you're interested for more shows, presentations, or news, you can go to cubbyhole.com. And also, if you have any questions regarding the topics for these shows, please don't be scared. Don't be afraid to email me at cubbyhole@mail.com. And that being said, I'm your host, Nate Cap. Thank you for listening. And keep in mind to do no harm, defend truth, and keep transcending dogma.